From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, solar outbursts and other stories of high strangeness. Here's what's happening. A company in Mexico, a processing facility, has now voluntarily suspended production of salad mix that's been linked to the outbreak of a stomach bug in Iowa and Nebraska. Taylor Farms of California said its Mexican branch, Taylor Farms de Mexico, will not resume production and shipping of any salad mix, as well as lettuce and other salad mix components, without approval of the FDA. Production stopped on Friday. It's been shifted to domestic crops and processing facilities in the United States. Just who do you trust for your food? And listen to this story. They say that stomach aches may be a normal part of life for some children, but a new study shows that unexplained abdominal pain at an early age may cause anxiety or depression come adulthood. Research published in Pediatrics shows that 51% of the children who had abdominal pain as children also had an anxiety disorder sometime during their lifetime. 30% had a current diagnosis at the time that they were surveyed. Bribes are routinely paid by major foreign pharmaceutical firms operating in China. Five drug salesmen for foreign companies told the BBC that their firms paid bribes in order to increase sales of their products. None of them wanted to be identified. They feared that they'd lose their jobs. The revelations came after China widens its investigation into drugs and price fixing, amid a bribery scandal engulfing drugs giant GlaxoSmithKline. You know, we talk a lot about near-death experiences on the program. Listen to this one. According to researchers now, near-death experiences could be caused by a surge of electrical firing in the dying brain, new research in animals suggests. In the study, rats whose hearts were stopped showed a surge of brain waves associated with consciousness, according to this study published in the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The researchers measured the animal's brain activity on EEG machines. However, whether the animals perceived that as a white light or tunnel of light, that's something we just don't know, according to the study researchers. Well, I tend to believe that there is something on the other side. A high-ranking Yemeni security official says the Obama administration's recently announced terror threat that supposedly targeted U.S. embassies had no basis in fact and was manufactured merely to dampen opposition to drone strikes. After initially warning of a terror plot thought to have been one of the most serious against American and other Western interests since the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. closed 20 embassies and consulates earlier this month, 18 of which reopened on Sunday. Let's check in with Douglas Hagman on this story. So Douglas, this Yemeni official, and we got to take it from there, says this whole thing was made up.
Well, I think when I was on your program last, I noted that the publicized threat to our embassies was not what it was presented to be, and I think that's been proven to be the case. But there's something that's still problematic. When you look at the embassy closings, when you put them on a map, we find that only a minority of these buildings were located in Muslim countries were closed. There were a couple of closures in North Africa, the area where the 9/11-12 protests and attacks took place, but most facilities remained open. So when we look at this, we find that essentially the entire region of the Persian Gulf was locked down, as was the sub-region of the Middle East, which tells us that perhaps, and based on information from my sources, that these closures appear to have been directly related to upcoming military maneuvers and posturing with respect to what might be taking place in the short term in Syria.
Yeah, but can we take this Yemeni official, and can we listen to this guy? Could he be truthful, or is he a liar?
Well, I wouldn't call him a liar. I think that perhaps he's stating making statements based on the information that he has. And in fact, certainly those appear to be valid claims, but perhaps not the reason for the embassy closings.
Okay, Doug, thank you so much. Take a look at our story, our highlight reel at coasttocoastam.com. How would you like to go from Los Angeles to San Francisco in 30 or 35 minutes or some other city like that? Well, it's possible soon. Electromagnetic acceleration. That's the high technology behind the high-speed transit concept that billionaire Elon Musk calls the Hyperloop. Musk, who already is leading roles in SpaceX rocket ventures, the Tesla electric car, and his Solar City solar energy company, has now unveiled his vision of what is called the Hyperloop. The plan is aimed at cutting the travel time between San Francisco and LA. The price, $20 for a one-way trip. Go take a look at it. It's like it's in this hyper tube of electromagnetic field. It's an amazing story there. Apple will unveil the latest version of its iPhone on September 10, likely to be called the iPhone 6 or the iPhone 5S. The phone's release date would fit the schedule Apple has already established since the first iPhone was released in 2007. Astronaut Michael Full, the most experienced British-born astronaut in the history of human spaceflight, has retired from NASA. Holding dual U.S.-UK citizenship, Dr. Full accumulated 375 days in orbit. In his 26-year career in NASA's Astronaut Corps, he flew on numerous shuttle and Soyuz missions. He serviced the Hubble telescope. He was on the Mir platform. And, of course, I had a chance to talk with him when he was on the International Space Station.
Alpha, this is Houston. Are you ready for the event?
Houston, this is Alpha. We are ready for the event.
From Mir Radio Network, this is Houston. Please call Alpha for a voice check.
Alpha, this is George Norrie, host of Coast to Coast AM on the Premier Radio Network. How do you hear me?
George, we hear you loud and clear. This is Michael Foe, commander on the International Space Station, and Alexander Kaleri, the flight engineer.
Well, Michael and Alexander, it's good to talk with you here down on planet Earth. Let me ask you, first of all, you're up there 250 miles above the planet. Are you able to pinpoint anything on the planet? Can you see, for example, the pyramids whenever you circle the globe?
The pyramids are only just visible if you know where to look and you have a pair of binoculars.
Dr. Full made a total of 6 trips into space and at one point held the record for the most cumulative time in orbit for a U.S. astronaut. The annual Perseid meteor shower dazzling stargazers around the world now. It's not over yet. The 2013 shower peaking right now, 100 meteors per hour. Let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. I was at the Joshua Tree this weekend for a speech at Contact in the Desert, Stephen,
yes,
and saw a few of the meteors. Had I been there tonight, I bet I would have seen a lot.
Absolutely, George. Meteor fever continues all around the coast audience and around the world. Some are saying as high as 75 to 100 meteors per hour. Here's the skinny. Sky watchers still look high into the northeast, George, as we continue to see the constellation Perseus rise. It's probable that tonight should be the peak, and hopefully everybody will get to see it. But folks, if you only get to see one or two meteors, know this. The parent comet is a comet called Swift-Tuttle. It goes around the sun every 133 years, George, and it's been described as the largest solar system object that makes a repeated close pass to the Earth, and some describe it, and I quote, as the single most dangerous object known to humanity. Its next close passage to the Earth. Now, we're not saying it's going to hit the Earth, but it's probable, George, in the future that it, who knows, it could.
Oh, boy.
July 12th, 2126, so even if you're seeing one or two Perseids, know that this may be the comet that could theoretically in the future, the far distant future, change the outlook and the future of mankind. Interesting stuff.
Just keep watching the skies, Doc. Thank you. Hydraulic fracturing or fracking is the process of drilling and injecting fluid into the ground at a high pressure in order to fracture shale rocks to release natural gas inside. Some people say that's dangerous. Others say no. A Saudi prince says, hey, let's stop doing this. Meanwhile, David Cameron, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, says, look, energy benefits are more important than environmental concerns. And he said that we should accept fracking. Up next, we're going to check in with Richard Heinberg, author of Snake Oil, how fracking's false promise of plenty imperils our future. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Richard Heinberg with us, best known as a leading educator on peak oil, the point at which we reach maximum global production and the impact that it will have on economic, food, and transport systems. Senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute, also author of Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Here he is back on Coast to Coast. Hello, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And you, George?
Good. Looking forward to this. You know, there's a lot of confusion about fracking. I gave a little definition of it, but explain a little bit more about it.
Well, the essential technology of fracking was developed several decades ago, actually, the idea of pumping water under pressure to fracture rocks to release oil or gas. But it's really only in the last few years, the last decade, that this technology has been used with horizontal drilling and with special cocktails of chemicals and explosives to release oil and natural gas from tight oil or shale gas bearing rocks, primarily shale, but also some other similar rocks. These are rocks that have very low permeability. They just don't want to give up the oil or gas. And so that's why the fracturing and the use of usually something like 3-4 million gallons of water per well under high pressure with as I said, a whole cocktail of chemicals and sand to keep the pores open once the rock has been fractured.
The Saudi prince, the billionaire Saudi prince, Richard, he claims fracking is extremely dangerous and devastating, wants it out of his kingdom. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's possible that the Saudis have a little hidden agenda here because, of course, they would they're seeing U.S. oil production increasing right now as a result of fracking, and the Saudis naturally want to keep their share of the global market. Nevertheless, there is a growing body of evidence to suggest that fracking is problematic from an environmental perspective. There was a story in the L.A. Times just last week talking about an internal Environmental Protection Agency report that showed very substantial harms to drinking water and to the air from fracking. And the EPA bigwigs, I guess, were killing this information and suppressing it from getting out to the public.
In what regions is fracking going on?
Okay, well, fracking for natural gas is happening in Texas, in Oklahoma, in Arkansas, also in the Marcellus Shale, which is under Pennsylvania. New York State is not actually drilling, but the Marcellus is present under New York State, also West Virginia, also in Colorado. And Utah, there are shale rocks that are both liquid and gas bearing. Now, when we're talking about liquids, tight oil, it's mostly in the Bakken shale, which is in North Dakota, and then in southern Texas in a play called the Eagle Ford. So there are about a dozen major geological formations that are shale-bearing rocks that are producing oil and gas right now.
Are we getting any reports from contaminated well water in those states?
Well, yes. It depends on who you talk to. The companies, the industry, deny that there's any risk to water. But of course, they have a vested interest in this. There have been documented reports both of contamination of water underground and also many situations where the fracking water that's taken up out of the well, then it's not only is it contaminated with the various chemicals that are used in fracturing, but it also picks up all kinds of minerals and radioactivity from underground. And there's the problem of what to do with that water, whether to put it in containment ponds or send it to treatment plants. And there are many documented instances of contamination from what's called produced water. So yes, now as I said, the industry denies this, and they do so largely on the basis of the fact that where there are environmental and human health problems, the first thing they do is try to settle with the people involved, give them write them $1 million check or whatever it takes. But part of that settlement is always a non-disclosure agreement so that the people involved can't talk about it. And so that's why it's been difficult to document some of these instances.
Well, now in this case, where some people claim that, you know, it's contaminating the water, and of course the industry denies it, how do we prove it?
Well, we prove it with studies, and the information that the EPA was collecting in by its field agents is really important in this regard, because there aren't that many studies that have been done. It's difficult to collect the data. And so the EPA, of course, is perfectly situated to do this, but it's really distressing to know that the EPA officials have suppressed evidence of contamination that was collected by their own field workers.
The title, of course, to your new book, Snake Oil, How Fracking's False Promise of Plenty Imperils Our Future. Explain that.
Right. Well, enormous claims have been made for what fracking can do for us. Over the past few years, we've seen ads in newspapers and on television and radio almost constantly telling us that the U.S. is going to be energy independent, that we have 100 years of cheap natural gas ahead of us, that the U.S. is going to be producing more oil than Saudi Arabia soon, and we will be even exporting oil to other countries. We at Post Carbon Institute wanted to find out how accurate these claims were, so we bought the rights to drilling data for all 65,000 currently producing shale gas and tight oil wells in the United States, and we ran the numbers. We looked at initial production rates when the wells were first drilled. We looked at decline rates. We looked at the geography of where these wells were, and what we found was that there are core areas within each of these plays, usually just a few counties, that are highly productive and economic. But you get outside of those core areas and the wells have lower initial production rates and they decline very rapidly. So taking all of those factors into account, it appears to us that this is going to be a short-term bubble. Both shale gas and tight oil will continue to increase, probably more tight oil than shale gas, over the next few years. And then around 2020 or maybe a couple of years earlier, we'll see that level off and start to decline. So this is nothing like what we're being told by a lot of the energy pundits.
Is there a way that Americans can just protest and uproar about this?
Well, that's already happening. All across fracking land, whether it's in Texas or Pennsylvania or West Virginia or Colorado, hundreds of anti-fracking groups have formed just within the last 3-4 years.
So it's getting bigger.
Oh, yes. And we're not talking about professional environmentalists. We're talking about small landowners, people who have fracking going on next door, and they just can't put up with the noise, with the fumes and the odors and the tainted well water and so on. And they're getting together with their neighbors and doing what they can to get this regulated or stopped.
Are they going to be able to, Richard? Do you think they have that kind of clout?
They've had success in some places. I mean, look at Colorado right now. You have the city of Longmont that voted 60% to ban fracking within city limits. So you've got over half the people of Longmont, Colorado, saying, no, we don't want this happening in our town. Now, unfortunately, the state of Colorado is suing them to try to overturn that. So it's not a very democratic situation. The people have expressed their wishes in Longmont, but similar things are happening in New York State and parts of Pennsylvania. We're seeing a big public backlash against fracking, and the industry, frankly, is on the defensive.
Well, maybe so. We're going to talk a little bit about peak oil with you too, Richard, when we come right back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. Split show for you tonight. Later on, Robert Schock joins us as we talk about solar outbursts and also earth mysteries. Make sure you're part of that. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with Richard Heinberg about fracking, of course. And welcome back to Coast, Richard Heinberg with us. Richard, let's talk a little bit about peak oil. As you know, I'm an abiotic oil guy. And sure. Let's talk about some of your work. And where are we standing right now with this?
Well, right now we're seeing oil production increases primarily in the United States as a result of production in North Dakota and South Texas. The rest of the world is pretty much flat. If you're talking about regular conventional oil, we've been on a plateau since about 2005 in terms of world production. There have been increases in natural gas liquids, which aren't really used for the same purposes as regular conventional oil and only have about 60% of the energy per unit. And there has been some increase in biofuels, mm-hmm. and so on. But regular conventional oil is pretty much flat.
That flat.
And that's why we're seeing the high oil prices. You know, 10 years ago, oil was selling for more like $30 a barrel. Now it's about 105, something like that. And nobody in official agencies like the U.S. Department of Energy or the International Energy Agency 10 years ago was forecasting that oil would be priced above $100 a barrel today. And yet here we are, and it really requires prices at that level now to provide incentives for the oil industry to go out and look for new sources of oil, because basically all that's left to find are the unconventional sources like the tar sands up in Canada, or heavy oil in Venezuela, or the tight oil up in North Dakota. Regular conventional oil that the industry used to find in big pools back in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, it's just not there anymore.
Yeah, but, you know, with peak oil and with oil in general, isn't it like the diamond industry? You just hold back as much as you can so the prices will go up?
Well, there's no evidence that the industry actually is doing that. There is evidence, quite the contrary, that the OPEC nations, for example, have overstated their reserves by about 50%, that there's about half the oil in OPEC that they publicly claim. So, there's really no every producer is producing just about flat out right now, and that includes Saudi Arabia.
Well, is it also true, though, Richard, that some empty fields fill back up again years later?
That's been observed in a couple of instances. There was an instance in the Gulf of Mexico, but this was a situation where the source rocks were close by, and the field was just refilling from the source rocks at a very, very low or slow rate. So it's not... fields aren't refilling at any rate that would enable them to be commercially produced.
Well, as you look at this, and we are pumping, how many gallons and barrels of oil are we pumping out?
Well, every day the world uses about 75 million barrels of regular conventional oil.
75 million every day.
That's right.
And they're keeping up with it.
Yes, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, we're really running through this stuff like there's no tomorrow. And if you think about it, it's pretty crazy, because this is a depleting, non-renewable resource that nature has given us, and we're trying to use it as fast as we humanly can. And, if it's such great stuff, you'd think we'd be saving some for the next generations.
How do you think oil has been made?
How it was made?
Created, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it was formed during two relatively brief periods, ironically enough, of extreme global warming, about 60 million years ago and about 150 million years ago. The seas, as a result of the climate at that time, the algae and other tiny plant species in the oceans proliferated and absorbed all the oxygen in the water. So when they died and fell to the bottoms of the seas, they didn't decompose as they would in an oxygen-rich environment, and they were covered over with sediment and under pressure over the course of tens of millions of years, these carbohydrates were turned into hydrocarbons.
It couldn't be that much, though, Richard.
We're talking about several cubic miles of this stuff, maybe 100 cubic miles, and that's what nature created. We're running through it as fast as we can.
I mean, how does this explain oil under the seabed, thousands of feet down?
Right. Well, most of that is in the continental shelves. There's very little oil to be found in the deep ocean trenches. It's mostly close to the continents. And of course, those areas have been repeatedly above water and then submerged. So this is not an anomaly.
Well, yet you'll have some scientists like the late Thomas Gold and a lot of these Russian scientists of days gone back who will swear by the abiotic oil theory that this planet has an abundance of oil and that it was basically formed during the planet's inception.
Right. Well, you know, Thomas Gold did persuade the Swedish government to test his theory, and they did drill a well at considerable expense into deep bedrock. And I think they produced something like 80 barrels of oil, which was, you know, a tiny, if they'd sold the oil on the market, it would have brought a tiny, tiny fraction of what it cost to drill the well. So it really didn't confirm the theory, and those 80 barrels could have come from the drilling mud. It's not clear what the source of them was.
And I guess one of the bottom lines here, Richard, too, is regardless of whether we continue with fracking, or whether oil runs out or not, we need to go to a different kind of energy system and source. And I don't see that really happening. Do you?
Well, it's not happening at anything like the speed that it would need to. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. Our energy conversation in the United States, I think, has been hijacked by the oil and gas industry over the past couple of years. Just a couple of years ago, we were all talking about how we have to get off of oil because we rely so much on imports, because it is depleting and non-renewable, because it is getting more expensive all the time, and because burning it has all kinds of environmental impacts. But that conversation has changed suddenly because of all of these extravagant claims for shale gas and tight oil. Now we're talking about the abundance that we have in the United States. Even President Obama has said we have 100 years of natural gas, and the companies are saying that, of course, we'll have plenty of oil to export over the next couple of decades. The evidence just isn't there to back up those claims, and we really need to get back to the conversation about how do we get off of oil.
Whatever happened to cold fusion? It just disappeared.
Well, you know, there's still a lot of people talking about it. There's this Italian fellow Rossi who claims to have I don't know if he calls it cold fusion, but it's some kind of motor that produces heat and supposedly produces more energy than it takes to run it. But there are a lot of skeptics. Rossi has been convicted of fraud in the past, so. He's not a very reliable character.
So, Richard, look into your energy crystal ball. I mean, where does what's going to happen? I mean, solar is not really, you know, growing. Windmill operations, people are complaining about that. What's out there?
Well, realistically, I think we're going to have less energy in our future. You know, the 20th century was a complete anomaly in all of human history because we had an abundance of cheap fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas. We were using energy at a pace, and we still are, completely unlike anything that human beings have ever done before. And we got used to it. We, you know, the Beverly Hillbillies became the norm. With planes, trains, automobiles, air conditioners, you name it, we found ways to use cheap energy. But nature doesn't necessarily produce energy just because we want to have it. If we want to have abundant energy in the future, we should be investing in the long range, renewable sources of energy like solar and wind. But even then, it's likely that because they're different from fossil fuels, because they're intermittent, because it costs a lot to produce solar panels and wind turbines, it's likely that, you know, we will be using energy differently in the future than we have in the past.
All around the country, sinkholes are popping up, Richard, gobbling up homes, roads, you name it. What the heck is going on there?
Yeah, well, in some cases, this does relate to oil and gas extraction.
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah, not in most of the instances, but in some, it's true. I mean, oil and gas, where they're present, are not just, you know, pools in the ground. They exist in pores of rocks, whether it's shale in the case of the plays we've been talking about, or more commonly sandstone or limestone, which are more porous. But, you know, they're in rock pores. So once you've extracted the oil and gas, the rock is still there. But nevertheless, the pressure has subsided. Oil and gas are normally present under tremendous pressure underground. So when they're extracted, it's common for the ground to subside by several inches, even up to several feet.
You know, I don't know, Richard, sometimes this sounds like a Twilight Zone episode, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah, and you know, science fiction authors have made a lot of references to planets where civilizations have come to an end because
yep.
they extracted all their resources and didn't plan for the future. And of course, you know, that's just projecting what we're doing onto other fantasy worlds.
If peak oil is correct, and those of you who believe it to be correct, explain how the dwindling of oil will occur. I mean, is it going to be the spigot's off and it's done? Or when do we really see that it's gone? I mean, right now you just said 75 million barrels a day we continue pumping out. There doesn't seem to be any end to that. I mean, is there gonna come a day in a year where they're gonna say, oh my gosh, we're down to 60 million a day. We can't make anymore. It's not coming out anymore.
Yeah. Well, most likely, sometime within the next few years, we will see production begin to decline. And it's not going to decline really rapidly, certainly not at first. It may decline by 1% or 2% per year in the early days. And then it'll pick up speed over the course of the decade of the 2020s and the 2030s. The rate of global production of oil will begin to decline pretty rapidly. And unless we've made plans for that, it's going to be pretty tough because our economy runs on oil. Think about all trade depends on ships and airplanes and trains and trucks, and all of those things burn refined petroleum. Unless we have some other way to make trade happen, our entire economy is going to start to shrink. And in some ways, I think that's actually already happening as a result of the high oil prices we've seen in the last few years. And that's one of the drags on the economy that's making it hard for us to recover from the crisis of 2008.
In your opinion, how long do we have before we completely just run out of oil?
Well, you know, that's really hard to answer. I think it'll be decades, many decades. Probably you and I and our children will no longer be around by the time that happens. But we won't have to run out of oil to experience serious economic hardship as a result of declining oil production. All oil has to do is start to decline and then continue declining by a percent or 2 or 3% per year. And we'll start seeing, you know, really serious consequences to our financial system, not to mention our food system and transport systems.
Well, it's going to be fascinating, Richard, to see all of this unfold. I hope it's not in my lifetime or my kids' kids' lifetime that it's way out there, which is one of the other problems. Nobody's thinking about the future of the people way out.
Right. Right. We discount the future. You know, I mean, financial analysts do this all the time. And the interests of future generations really just don't show up in the calculus of how we deal with the environment, with resources today. You know, you can think of this, we have a policy of deplete America first. You know, we're going to use all of our resources as fast as we can and then hope that the rest of the world has more resources that we can use. But at the end of the day, you know, we live on a finite planet, and whether we run out of this mineral or that fuel, you know, this century or next century, it in a way, it doesn't matter. It's a way of doing business that ultimately just has no future.
Well, we shall see soon enough. Richard, as you look toward all of this, who would you say is out there as one of the few people champion, let's say, fracking and doing away with it?
Who's opposing fracking?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there have been articles and a few books, and there's a guy named Josh Fox who has made a couple of documentaries, one called Gasland and another called Gasland 2. And of course, the people in the oil and gas industry just hate this guy because they say, you know, his movies are sensationalistic and exaggerated and so on. But he's changed a lot of people's minds. And Matt Damon made a movie last year called Promised Land, which was about fracking. It wasn't as over the top as Josh Fox's work is, at least in some people's eyes. It was much more subtle, but you know, it showed what it's like to live in a community where the oil and gas companies are showing up to lease people's land for drilling. And it's not pretty.
No, it's not pretty at all. Richard, your website, would you give it out to people who want to track you?
Absolutely. It's richardheinberg.com, and folks can find a link to the book, Snake Oil, on that website, and also links to a lot of other stuff I've written.
You heard the comments of the United Kingdom's Prime Minister, David Cameron. He's simply saying, look, don't worry about fracking. Energy's more important. Do you think just about every government leader is saying the same thing? President Obama seems to.
Yes, he certainly is. It's not uniform. France has banned fracking, and a few other countries are leaning that way. But you know, Britain has benefited enormously from the oil and gas of the North Sea, and that stuff is running out. North Sea production has plummeted in the last decade, and so Britain has become a major oil and gas importer. And I think the government there is looking at fracking as kind of, you know, its last opportunity to avoid, you know, economic ruin as a result of their past policies, really, because they exported all of that oil from the North Sea at super low prices, you know, at $10 a barrel. And now they're paying over $100 a barrel to import oil.
All right, stick with us. Richard Heinberg, our special guest. One more hour to go. We're going to take phone calls with him as we talk about peak oil and fracking. And then later on tonight, I'll be talking, of course, to Richard Schock about some mysteries around this planet and also solar outbursts. And as you well know, Richard is an expert on Egypt and some of the strange mysteries there. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.